Okay, I'll be reading from Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 10, verses 1 through 18. Now I, Paul, myself appeal to you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. I, who am humble among you in person, but bold toward you when absent, I beg you that when I am present, I will not need to be bold with the confidence by which I plan to challenge certain people who think we are living according to the flesh. For although we live in the flesh, we do not wage war according to the flesh, since the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but are powerful through God for the demolition of strongholds. We demolish arguments and every proud thing that is raised up against the knowledge of God, and we take every thought captive to obey Christ. We are ready to punish any disobedience once your obedience is complete. Look at what is obvious. If anyone is confident that he belongs to Christ, let him remind himself of this. Just as he belongs to Christ, so do we. For if I boast a little too much about our authority, which the Lord gave for building up you and not for tearing you down, I will not be put to shame. I don't want to seem as though I'm trying to terrify you with my letters. For it is said, his letters are weighty and powerful, but his physical presence is weak and his public speaking amounts to nothing. Let such a person consider this. What we are in our letters when we are absent, we will also be in our actions when we are present. For we don't dare classify or compare ourselves to some who commend themselves. But in measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves to themselves, they lack understanding. We, however, will not boast beyond measure, but according to the measure of the area of ministry that God has assigned us to us, which reaches even to you. For we are not overextending ourselves as if we had not reached you, since we have come to you with the gospel of Christ. We are not boasting beyond measure about other people's labors. On the contrary, we have the hope that as your faith increases, our area of ministry will be greatly enlarged, so that we may preach the gospel to the regions beyond you without boasting about what has already been done in someone else's area of ministry. So let the one who boasts boast in the Lord, for it is not the one commending himself who is approved, but the one the Lord commends. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning, Infant Church. My name's Tom, and it's a pleasure to be back with you guys. I've been sort of in and out the last couple weeks, and while I've been here on Sundays, I haven't been here during the week, and so I've missed you a lot. And glad to be with you, opening God's Word with you. We're in this end stretch of the second letter to the Corinthians, and there's a big turn in Paul's vocabulary, in his force, to the point that some people have concluded this is a separate letter that's been added so that now we have the correspondence to the Corinthians. Some people think that it was added from before, some people afterwards, some people think it's all part of the same thing. And really, no matter what view you take, it's been added here by somebody who knows what they're doing for a reason. And so it's not out of place. What Paul is doing is he's concluding the end of this letter with his strongest appeal to this church that he loves to separate themselves from the so-called super apostles, and we're going to get there in coming chapters, but to separate themselves from those people and rejoin the family of God. They're preaching a fake Jesus, a fake gospel, and saying that you can't trust Paul, and he's using the strongest language possible to try and finish the job so that when the delegation comes to to Corinth to collect the money for the people in Jerusalem, they won't be having to do correction. You know, he says, please, don't make me come to you with power. I want to come with meekness, right? And what he's doing in chapter 10 is he's comparing his ministry and his posture towards the Corinthians to the apostles that are preaching a fake Jesus. He's doing this comparison thing, and they're doing it too. And so this brings up this question of assessment. All of us are aware of it. I would wager that all of us are aware of it. We are all constantly being graded. There is an assessment of our lives that is constantly coming against whether or not we are good enough, strong enough, powerful enough, good-looking enough, mature enough, etc. You know, we always deal with this comparison thing, and we tend to organize our life around it. It tends to determine what we purchase for clothing. It determines how we think about vocation. We're constantly being graded, and we're constantly organizing our lives accordingly. And so Paul is going to talk about this tendency towards comparison, not directly, but by way of looking at the comparison between these super apostles and his own ministry and his ministry team. And so we're going to look at the competition Paul's in, we're going to look at the confidence that he has, and then we're going to look at the comparison he uses. And so look with me in 2 Corinthians 10, verse 1. And he says this, he opens with, "Now I, Paul, myself appeal to you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, I who am humble among you in person, but bold toward you when absent." And the accusation against him is, well, you guys all laughed at it, right? He doesn't talk very well. He's not very impressive. He tries to make up for it with these strong letters. He tries to be bold when he's not around, but when he comes, we see who he really is. And Paul says, well, it's not just me. I appeal to you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. He's adopted the character of Jesus Christ. And so he even uses words that are similar to what Jesus says in Matthew 11, where he says, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon me, because I am gentle and humble in heart." The character of Jesus has been embodied in Paul's ministry. And he goes on in verse 2, and he says, "I beg you that when I'm present, I will not need to be bold with the confidence by which I plan to challenge certain people who think we are living according to the flesh." And the Greek literally says, "Not being present, I beg to be bold with the confidence I will have when I challenge certain people." So he's asking for permission to be bold, which should elicit a chuckle, right? Boldness doesn't ask for permission. He's using irony. He's actually demonstrating remarkable rhetorical skill with his language and this challenge that he's leveling. He goes on, he says, "For although we live in the flesh," they say he lives according to the flesh. He's being persecuted. He's not very impressive. Obviously a very worldly person. We are spiritual. You know, we're not like that. And Paul says, well, we don't live according to the flesh. But yeah, we live in the flesh. "Although we live in the flesh, we do not wage war according to the flesh. Since the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but are powerful through God for the demolition of strongholds. We demolish arguments and every proud thing that is raised up against the knowledge of God, and we take every thought captive to obey Christ. We are ready to punish any disobedience once your obedience is complete." So the opponents present themselves as spiritual because of their letters of recommendation. Some of the things we've already talked through, letters of recommendation, ecstatic religious experiences, spiritual power. They're actually healing people, right? They've got this wonder-working rhetorical skill, and they're saying, we are spiritual. We're really impressive. Paul, on the other hand, doesn't talk very well. He's a loser. You should ignore him. And Paul's response is strange. He doesn't out-argue them. He doesn't come up over the top and he's like, actually, I'm really amazing. And, you know, instead he says, yeah, totally. But, you know, I'm not playing that game. I'm not playing the power game. I'm not playing the comparison game. I'm measuring my life and my ministry by a completely different set of values. And so I adopt the character of Jesus Christ. Paul's preference, we read, is to build them up rather than tear down. He would rather not have to come with boldness. He'd rather not have to be correcting these super apostles. He'd rather be there for the purpose of encouraging and helping them to mature, right? And he says, we take every mind captive, not every thought. So it's a cognitive translation that we have. It says, we take every thought captive. But Paul literally says, every mind. He wants the whole person. He wants to win the whole person to faith in Jesus. And the obedience that comes from faith in Christ. Paul's using a measuring stick that just completely blows the categories of these super apostles. They're measuring themselves by what is impressive, and he's measuring himself by Jesus and the gospel. And so I'd have a question for you. What is your measuring stick? What do you use to assess whether or not you or someone else is impressive, successful? What do you use to measure your value? In 2 Corinthians 10, verses 7 through 11, Paul talks about this. He says, look at what is obvious. If anyone is confident that he belongs to Christ, let him remind himself of this. Just as he belongs to Christ, so do we. So he's saying, hey, these people are saying they belong to Jesus. Well, you want to play the comparison game? You want to look at what's obvious? So do we. For if I boast a little too much about our authority, which the Lord gave me for building you up and not for tearing you down, I will not be put to shame. I don't want to seem as though I'm trying to terrify you with my letters, for it is said, his letters are weighty and powerful, but his physical presence is weak and his public speaking amounts to nothing. Let such a person consider this. What we are in our letters when we are absent, we will also be in our actions when we are present. So he issues this warning. Hey, you think that our letters are impressive? Well, be assured, if you don't turn away from this false gospel and this false Jesus, like, we'll be what we are in our letters in present. But he starts off, but he says, look at what is obvious. And the problem with the comparison game, this constant determination of somebody's value based off of externals, is it's just always superficial. It looks at things like physical presentation. Are they pretty or not? Are they handsome or not? Do they wear the right clothes? Do they use the right vocabulary? Did they go to the right schools? Do they have enough money? Are they good at sports? Are they good at music? Like, are they a good mom? Are they a good dad? Are they a good spouse? Are they valuable? It looks at the superficial things, which if you were born in the right place at the right time with the right resources, anybody can accumulate the superficial. You know what I mean? Like, it's not because of some internal value that you were born attractive. It's not because of some internal value that you were born with a brain that could remember a lot of stuff and therefore like synthesize ideas and recapitulate them as your own. All of these superficial external factors that the super apostles are using to gauge are mostly a result of God's mysterious providence. You were born at a time and place where you have access to, like, health, life-saving health, medical procedures. Most of us, if we were accidentally born 500 years ago, would be dead by now. You know, like, it's not because of something you did that you have the ability to appear impressive in our culture. In other words, a superficial assessment that plays that comparison game, that pretty game, that power game, whatever game you're playing, isn't an accurate measuring tool. Paul says you want to play the comparison game? Look at what's obvious. We obviously belong to Jesus, and the Corinthians are an obvious example of how that's true. We came, we preached the gospel, they became a church. Come on, use your brains, Corinthians. There's really two competing systems for approval, two competing ways that we try to gain other people's approval, two ways that we think about comparison. Either we do it by trying to impress one another, so we're climbing the ladder, but the problem is as you climb the ladder of approval, you're always looking up, hopefully. You know, don't look down, it'll scare you. You're looking up, and so if you follow the metaphor, you're always looking at what's above you. somebody's always going to be more attractive, more intelligent, have it all together. Somebody's always going to be better. And that's going to lead to despair or discouragement or being driven. And then the other one is attack. You step on people as you're going up that ladder of approval. Stomp them down. You're putting them down, like the people here. They're putting Paul down. They're saying, he's nothing. Don't worry about him. When we compare each other based off of a superficial measuring stick, we're always in danger of despair as we constantly try to impress others and realize there's always going to be somebody better. Or we're always in danger of arrogance and ignorance, because if you're only looking down and you only see the people that are worse than you, you'll grow in arrogance, but also you won't realize like there are a lot of people that are better than you. So who are you comparing yourself? What's your measuring stick, but who are you comparing yourself to? What are you comparing yourself to? I think if you answer that question, it'll show you a lot about what's in your heart and what your ultimate value system is. Do you value control? Then people who have it all together will appear very impressive to you. Do you value beauty and comfort? Then people that are beautiful and easy to be around are going to be the people that you aspire to be like. Do you value power? You know, these things will determine who you think is worth your time, worth your attention. In 2 Corinthians 10, verses 12 through 16, Paul goes on and he further, I think for us, helps diagnose this comparison problem. He says, we don't dare classify or compare ourselves with some who commend themselves. But in measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves to themselves, they lack understanding. We, however, will not boast beyond measure, but according to the measure of the area of ministry that God has assigned to us, which reaches even to you. For we're not overextending ourselves, as if we had not reached you, since we have come to you with the gospel of Christ. But we are not boasting beyond measure about other people's labors. On the contrary, we have the hope that as your faith increases, our area of ministry will be greatly enlarged so that we may preach the gospel to the regions beyond you without boasting about what has already been done in someone else's area of ministry. See, Paul starts off with diagnosing the issue at hand, comparison. They're comparing each other to each other. And he says that they prove that they have no understanding. Now, when you think about understanding, you think, again, probably cognitive, but what's going on in the Bible? Lack of understanding is a theological term. If you look in the book of Proverbs, pretty much anywhere, but also if you look in Psalm 14 or Psalm 53 or Isaiah 52 or 53, Jeremiah 9, a lack of understanding is always a theological term that means somebody doesn't have a real relationship with God. It's theological, not just cognitive. It means they don't know who God is. And knowing is always a participatory, relational, experiential word. They haven't had experience with God. They don't practice the way of the Lord. And he says, by comparing themselves to each other, they show that they don't have a relationship with God. See, the problem that comes with a superficial comparison to other people is that we've elevated something above God as our standard for value. The deeper question, belief, underneath, is that impressive? Is that valuable? Is, am I enough? Do I matter? When we play the comparison game, what we're actually saying is, do I belong? The question of do I belong, when we play that comparison game with superficial meter or measurements, means that the answer will always be no. It will always be no. Because if you're constantly looking up, trying to attain some level of whatever it is, power, beauty, coolness, it isolates you from other people. You always feel like you don't measure up. There's that insecurity. And there's nothing quite more isolating than the insecure person constantly trying to break in, right? Because they're always told no. There's nothing more desperate than somebody who knows they don't belong but is trying really hard. And so you you end up with a no answer to the question of, am I good enough? Am I valuable? Do I belong? But likewise, the person that constantly steps on others, that constantly puts other people down as they're trying to ascend the ladder, like, those aren't going to be friends, right? And the people ahead of you that you're not looking at, they're looking down and they're noting the pattern. Oh, this person just uses people to ascend the ladder of success, to try and accumulate value. And so the answer to am I enough is always no. That's because comparison is kind of a rigged game. There's always somebody better, always somebody worse, but there's no real end point. So whatever you're pursuing in order to fill that need in the depth of your soul to be enough will never be enough. I think soul, if you want to speak poetically, let me speak poetically. The way I would define the human soul, not biblically, just my own thoughts, is a combination of two empty outstretched arms and a heart full of longing. Just a big black hole that needs something big enough to fill it. And when we play the comparison game, we constantly shove things in those empty arms and that longing heart and find it never to be enough. They don't just compare themselves to one another, but they also take credit for Paul's work. Did you notice that they're showing up in his area of ministry? They're taking credit for the conversion of the Corinthians. And Paul says, hey, that's not what we want to do. We're not taking credit for what other people have done. We want to further the gospel in new places, for sure, but we're not going to go visit somebody else's church and then try and be their leaders. What he's doing here is he's pointing to God. This is actually not even taking credit for his own work. He's saying this is the area God's entrusted to us. It's the area God wants us to work in. It's the area God is working himself. And so it's the area that we're called to. We're not going to go take credit for somebody else's stuff. Meanwhile, they're very secure in taking credit for somebody else's stuff. And this is one of the patterns of comparison, is that when we're using superficial means of assessing the value of other people, when we're comparing ourselves to one another, we begin to take credit for other people's stuff. And sometimes that's just plagiarism, outright plagiarism, because it'll make us look more impressive. But often, more often, I would say, it's associating ourselves with the success of other people, getting into the cool club, which, by the way, the cool club doesn't exist. And the people that think they're in the cool club are definitely not in the cool club. And the people that want to be in the cool club aren't in the cool club. And the only people that are in the cool club don't know it exists and don't really care about it. Like, but when we try and say, oh, I'm friends with so-and-so, or I know this guy, and we're constantly trying to say, I'm enough, I'm cool, I'm good, there's nothing quite so miserable and insecure as a professional musician, speaking personally. And to my great shame, I spent the majority of my teens and 20s taking credit for other people's stuff. And I did it by name dropping and saying, oh, I toured with so-and-so, I played with this band, oh yeah, I know him, oh, they're great, yeah, blah, 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 blah. And I'd name drop all these bands that I was looking up the ladder of success and thinking, man, if I could only get up there. And the really miserable thing about this is none of them are all that famous. I could say any number of them and you'd be like, who? But to me, I was trying to take credit for other people's success in the world that I was in. Do we want to be that kind of community that's looking at the superficial things and constantly measuring one another against them, deciding that if I wear these shoes or if I school my kids in this way or if I'm involved in this particular activity, it means I'm really something? Or do we want to be the kind of community that has a different metric? One that's not taking credit for other people's stuff or by attaining value by association, but one where we're actually connected for who we really are, apart from all the superficial stuff, where you can be you and that is enough. I think that is the only kind of community I'm interested in being a part of, I mean, if you go out into the world, like, aren't you tired of having to perform? Aren't you tired of having to convince somebody else that you are valuable and worth their time? It would be great if this could be the kind of place where the baseline was, you are valuable, and you are worth my time, and it doesn't matter if I sit in your section during the 5-minute break, I see you're alone, and I'm just going to go say hi. That would be really cool. We don't want to take credit for what other people have done, because we don't want to be plagiarists, but we also don't want to be name droppers. But the paradox of the Christian life, the paradox of real value is that you ultimately have to take credit for somebody else. You have to be associated. And that's exactly where Paul goes. In verses 17 and 18, he says, "So let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. For it is not the one commending himself who is approved, but the one the Lord commends." And so on the surface, it seems like, oh, well, like, let's just play the spiritual game. You know, let me boast about what God's doing, which I find just really discouraging and not very attractive at all when we spiritualize the comparison game. Oh, the Lord did this for me. It was so amazing. The Lord answered my prayer. Oh, I'm suffering a lot, but, you know, God's with me. When we're painting silver linings around hard things, when we're using spiritual language to just amp up the spirituality of ourselves and make ourselves, it's the same thing. It's the same game. Paul's not saying that. He's not saying, yeah, just like add, tack God on to the end of your boast. Instead, he's actually quoting from Jeremiah 9, 23 through 24, which says this. This is what Yahweh says. The wise person should not boast in his wisdom. The strong should not boast in his strength. The wealthy should not boast in his wealth. But the one who boasts should boast in this, that he understands, there's that word, understanding, and knows me, that I am the Lord, showing faithful love and justice and righteousness on the earth. For I delight in these things. This is Yahweh's declaration. Let the one who boasts boast in this, that he knows me. Not that he's powerful, not that God is doing really cool things in his area of ministry, not that she has finally figured out how to get her kids to love Jesus and obey everything right in the moment, not that we've figured out how to pray so that God answers every request. Let us boast that we know God and his character. Did you see? It's showing faithful love, justice, righteousness. It's like the most famous verse in the whole Bible, Exodus 34, right? Where God shows up and he says, this is who I am. This is what I'm like. He displays his character. Let the one who boasts boast in this, that he has a relationship with God. See, ultimately, assessing yourself by a superficial measuring stick, playing the comparison game with other people, this is actually what the Bible, one of the things the Bible means by the word sin. If you're not a Christian, like, you've probably heard sin before and thought, like, oh yeah, like murder, cheating, stealing, killing, all that kind of stuff. I get that. But the Bible has a more expansive view of what sin is. Sin is vandalism, it's pollution, it's rebellion. But it's basically anything that elevates God or demotes God and elevates something above him. And so when we're playing the comparison game, when we're saying, I will know I am worth something if we're elevating something above God, we're engaged in a sinful pattern, thought pattern, and probably life pattern. That's what the Bible means by sin, is when we elevate something above God. And what the Bible means by faith, we often think it's knowing the right things, right? That's typically what, on a popular level, people think faith is. Oh, if you know, like, that God exists, that makes you, like, a, you know, Christian or something, I don't know. You know, this vague idea that it's just believing the right things. But what the Bible means by faith is totally different. It means knowing and being known. It means participating in. And ultimately what it means, and what it means right here, is taking credit for something God has done. That's because what Paul has done in his ministry is preached a gospel that says the answer to your question, am I enough, can only be yes if somebody else has done what you were unable to do. If somebody was able to live not just a sinless kind of life, but a sin-free kind of life, a life where there was zero failure, ultimate success. And this is Jesus. And that rather than using that power to like get everybody to just be good boys and girls and obey, basically stomping on people, rather than climbing the ladder and stomping on people on the way up and using that power to manipulate and control us, he's used it to set us free by dying for us. He allowed himself to be trampled. He allowed himself to be killed. And not just as a great example, but as a sacrifice that cleansed his people, that won forgiveness of sin, so that our status in here, maybe superficially it doesn't look like that, but our status and our relationship with God is now based off of what he's done. So we take the credit through a relationship. That's what faith is. It's trusting that what he says, this is for you, is actually for you, and receiving it in the context of a restored relationship with God. The most important verdict of your life has already been handed down. And it takes care of the comparison sin problem and all the other sin problems and invites you into a relationship of love that looks at you as you really are and says, yeah, you are enough. You're enough. I love you. I want relationship with you, and isn't pretending. Isn't asking you to get your act together so you can ascend some spiritual maturity ladder and finally be acceptable to God. Rather, it's inviting you in and saying, you're already enough. I already love you. This is the verdict. It's not by the people in the room, not the people you compare yourself to, not me, not anybody else in the room. Let the one who boasts boast in this, that Jesus Christ died for their sins and loves them and wants life with them forever. And that'll free you from the comparison game of having to constantly measure yourself, because if God himself says, yeah, the answer is yes, you are enough, then it doesn't matter what anybody else says. Now, it doesn't matter in the sense of, they can't change that. Like, we should actually care what other people think, because we care about other people, right? We don't want to be like my default, which is like, eh, whatever. Yeah, you don't want to be the aloof, disconnected person. But you also don't want to be a person that's always at the mercy of somebody else's assessment of you. And the gospel says God's assessment of you is greater than any assessment anybody else could give. And so that frees you from the need to constantly compare. It also frees you from the need to assess other people. Because whether they've accepted it or not, other people are objects of God's love. They are recipients or potential recipients of Jesus' death. They are kings and queens in the kingdom of heaven. Like, your assessment doesn't really matter, no offense. And neither does mine. Like, every person sitting in here, if we could see each other as we really are, as God sees us, my goodness. I mean, C.S. Lewis has that quote in Mere Christianity, I think so, where he says, if we could see each other as we actually are, we'd be so glorious, we would be tempted to fall down and worship one another. It'd be unimaginable. But that's the reality, that because of what God has done for us, he has made us to be beautiful, whole, and belonging creatures in his kingdom. What Paul is going to go on to say is that these super apostles don't understand who God is, they don't understand who Jesus is, they don't understand the gospel, and it's put them into a position of power games, that constant need to fight fire with fire. You're going to try and be impressive, I'll be impressive. You're going to use violence, I'll use violence. You're going to use money, I'm going to use money. They're doing stuff according to the world. And what the gospel frees us from is that perpetual need to use the weapons of warfare of the world for the warfare that God has actually called us into. Because when we use the weapons of war that the world uses, then we just recapitulate that downward cycle of arrogance, of violence, manipulation, and control. But when we've been separated from that and brought into a kingdom where the way to win is to lose, the way to power is to serve, the way to love is to give yourself away, then that creates a community that's not just a subculture, but a counterculture, a different way of thinking and being and living in the world that I think is more attractive than anything this world could possibly offer. I mean, we could try really hard to do the power play game, the comparison game, and really build ourselves up, leverage all our resources to wear nothing but the best clothes and the most recent fashion, engage in some really good plastic surgery so that all of us look as attractive as the most attractive person. You know, like we could actually play that game, and it sounds as silly as I can possibly make it because it's just stupid. But if we've been invited into a counterculture, then we're all going to look actually pretty silly. It's that paradox. It's the old and the young, the beautiful and the ugly, the rich and the poor, like the intelligent and the unintelligent, the socially adept and the socially awkward, living together like a family where everyone belongs because everyone is loved by our God. Let me pray. Father, we are grateful that your gospel frees us from the need to seek approval from anyone because you've already given us approval by your Son. And we pray that you would continuously make us a community that looks like him, acts like him, and relates to one another and others like him. Give us humility, give us meekness, give us gentleness. Lord, I pray that you would speak to us now and show us areas where we have elevated something above you to assess whether or not we're valuable or whether others are valuable. And I pray that you would gently take it from us. Convince us that your assessment is more valuable and more authoritative than anything we could bring to the table. Lord, I pray you would meet with us as we come to the table. And that you would convince us that who you say we are is in truth real. Amen.